With support from Verde Gallery, currently featuring Landscapes, an exhibition of paintings by David Stratton. Also featuring Improv at Verde with the Zoo Theater Company on Wednesday, July 20th at 8 p.m. Verde Gallery, a fine art gallery, cafe, and newsroom at 17 East Taylor, downtown Champaign. On the web at verdant-systems.com. Be inspired. Programs on WILL are made possible in part by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we go back in time to the Gilded Age for a story about two founding fathers of American industry, their partnership, and the reason for their estrangement, a bloody steelworkers' strike. Our guest is writer Les Standiford, author of Meet You in Hell, Andrew Carnegie, Henry Clay Frick, and the Bitter Partnership That Transformed America. Carnegie and Frick, they were born in poverty but became wealthy and powerful as steelmakers. Les Standiford says the impact of their steelmaking enterprise on the economy at the end of the 19th century was as profound as the impact of the American Revolution had been on this country's politics and philosophy a century before. And Standiford says their business practices and the principles they embodied continue to affect us today. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with questions and comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If you're listening outside the Champaign-Urbana area, call us toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Les Standiford is the author of 10 novels, most recently Havana Run. He is also the author of the critically acclaimed Last Train to Paradise. He is the host of BookBeat on Miami Public Television, and he directs the creative writing program at Florida International University. His new book, Meet You in Hell, is published by Crown. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Les Standiford, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure, I assure you, Celeste.
Tell us the story that gives the book its title.
Well, as he was lying on his deathbed, Andrew Carnegie, who had always been concerned about the way other people felt about him, decided that he would make one last attempt to make up with his former partner, who'd turned bitter enemy, Henry Clay Frick. And he wrote a note to beseeching Frick that since they were both getting on and preparing to meet their makers, perhaps it was time to get together and try to mend their fences before they had to account for themselves in the hereafter. And when Frick got this note from Carnegie, as the story is told, he took one look at it and said to the man who brought it, "So Carnegie wants to meet, does he? Sure. You can tell him I'll meet him. I'll meet him in hell where we both are going."
Hmm.
He considered Carnegie a hypocrite. Had for some 20 years, and particularly over the last 20 years of his life, for spending most of his time trying to give away the largest personal fortune that had ever been amassed. That's what Carnegie spent most of the last 2 decades of his life trying to do. And in Frick's eyes, what he was trying to do was buy his way into heaven.
Mm.
But he was under no illusions as to where he thought they were both were going.
Yeah. In my introduction, I used the word estrangement, and I think that we could say that's putting it mildly. Maybe meltdown might be more appropriate.
Well, considering that they had formed what, by anybody's standards, would be the about the most profitable business partnership ever. It was beyond estrangement.
Yeah. An illustration of Frick's loathing of Carnegie, the skyscraper he built next to the Carnegie Building in Pittsburgh. Tell us about the act of trying to outdo Carnegie.
Well, if Carnegie spent the last 20 years of his life trying to give his money away, what Frick spent a large part of his time doing was trying to outdo his former partner. He was employed as the ranking board member of U.S. Steel, which was formed after Carnegie sold his holdings to J.P. Morgan in 1901. So he stayed in business, but a lot of his endeavors seemed to be directed at trying to outdo Carnegie. And one of those endeavors was the building of this skyscraper, which was about twice as tall as the former Carnegie offices where Frick had gone to work every day, and built so as to cast the building and just the Carnegie Building in just about perpetual shadow, right beside it. Mm. And there are other stories as to why Frick liked to go out on the roof and gaze down at that building where he had formerly worked, still owned by Carnegie. But I think we're going out to polite company, so I'll withhold some of those.
What were the backgrounds of these two men?
Well, Carnegie was an immigrant. He came with his family from Scotland in 1848 when he was 12 years old. They had not a cent. His father had been a weaver in Dunfermline, Scotland. He had terrible difficulty owing to the increasing industrialization of the mills continuing to get work. Carnegie's father, I'm talking about. And in the wake of the Irish potato famine, when all work, even the most menial, became almost impossible to come by, Carnegie's father finally decided that it was time to pack up and travel after some other, in the wake of some other Carnegie family members, and come to the United States. And Pittsburgh was where they settled. And Carnegie went to work as a bobbin boy in a mill for pennies a day, and finally worked his way, got a job as a messenger for a Western Union branch in Pittsburgh. And that's where he was discovered by a man named Tom Scott, who was then the superintendent of the Pennsylvania Railroad and was thinking about instituting a telegraph ancillary of his own to service the needs of the railroad. He walked into the telegraph office one day as Carnegie was exhibiting one of his skills. He was able to. He had the uncanny ability to listen to the clicks and clacks of Morse code and translate that directly into human speech. In other words, he could hear it and then tell you what was being coded out there by the operator on the other end. Most people had to write the clicks and clacks down and then sort of laboriously take a look and translate these into a written message, which, you know, we all know had the form of the telegram. But Carnegie could do that thing I just explained to you. Mm-hmm. Scott was taken by this and decided he'd found the person that whom he would put in charge of this project of getting his own telegraph company started. And that's what led Carnegie to his real rise. I mean, it took a while, of course, but that's where he jumped up from working man to favored position. And Frick had been the son of a failed farmer, a Mennonite in western Pennsylvania. He grew up about 40 miles east of Pittsburgh. He had an uncle who was successful, a man named Overholt. His father's wife's father, Abraham Overholt, took an interest in Frick, gave him a job in his distillery. They still make old Overholt whiskey, you know. And when the old man died, Frick used the prospect of an inheritance that was going to come to his mother and eventually some of it to him to go out and borrow some money to put him in business with a cousin in Coke. Coke is made of bituminous coal. In other words, he was buying coal mines and ovens used to transform that bituminous coal into coke. And he got his break, essentially, when his well-to-do uncle died and the prospect of an inheritance was due to the family. He went out and parlayed that into a loan from the Mellon Bank of Pittsburgh, and that set the stage for him to meet Andrew Carnegie, who'd gone on to get some tips from his mentor, Scott, at the Pennsylvania Railroad, make some investments, take a real leap, mortgage the family home at one point in order to buy into a stock, into a company that the Pennsylvania Railroad was going to do business with, and one thing led to another until finally Carnegie had a steel plant that needed a lot of coke, and that's what led to the meeting of the formation of this partnership between Carnegie and Frick. That's the short version of the story.
Yeah. How would you describe their temperaments?
Well, Carnegie was perhaps the more complex of the two because, as I think I said before, he was a man cognizant and solicitous of the opinions of others. And this was decidedly not a factor in Frick's makeup. He didn't care what people thought of him. He wanted to be successful, and if anybody didn't like the way he did business, well, they could go do business with someone else. He and Carnegie got along famously because, and I'm not the only one to have theorized this, Carnegie saw in Frick the kind of person who was very willing to do the sorts of things he understood were necessary to be successful in a pretty cutthroat business, but that he sometimes was Carnegie was sometimes uncomfortable with doing himself. So he had this sort of perfect projection. He'd found his patent, as it were, the man who could go out there and do the tough stuff without compunction, without second-guessing himself. And for a long time, that's how they prospered together.
Yeah. Both were risk-takers. Both knew their business, made it their business to know their business. And both were social Darwinists.
Well, they were both enamored of that, yes. They took the concepts of Darwinism, which social Darwinism, which Spencer took from Darwin, of course. Spencer saw social Darwinism essentially as an explanation of how certain currents had developed in human history. And Carnegie and Frick, and they weren't the only ones of their day to do this, of course, but they turned it into not an explanation, but a justification for just about any business practice that would get their company to the top. That you know, almost nothing was out of bounds if it meant getting an advantage on the other guy. It's a great story when a competing firm there in Pittsburgh came up with a way to cut out one of the stages of cooling and then reheating in steel. And that is the most expensive aspect of the steel process, is the tremendous amounts of fuel needed to raise iron and steel to molten levels, forms. Why, when a competitor figured out a way to cut out one of the cooling and reheating steps, Carnegie knew that he was going to be at a distinct price disadvantage. And so what he did was send a letter out to every customer every potential customer of this new steel plant, alleging that rails and plating produced in this manner would lack what Carnegie called homogeneity. Well, Carnegie didn't have the slightest idea what homogeneity was. He made it up. He plucked it out of thin air. But within days, orders started to dry up to this. Orders to this competitor started to dry up. In fact, they were on the verge of bankruptcy and panicked. The panic investors of the firm, when Henry Clay Frick walked in the door and offered them pennies on the dollar for their investment, they snapped at the chance because they thought it might be the only money that they'd ever see. And I think that's a perfect example of what was considered at the time standard business practice as perfected by these two men.
Who might these two men have become had they come of age in the latter half of the 20th century?
Well, I don't know. Maybe they would have become Bernie Ebert.
Yeah.
Actually, I would like to draw a distinction between them and the heads of places like Enron, WorldCom, and Tyco, because in their defense, Carnegie and Frick did see themselves as builders. And after all, as I think you suggested earlier on, they did contribute mightily to this this country and its development as an industrialized force in the industrial world. It's just that their accomplishments were awesome. It's just that they also came at some rather lamentable and even awesome costs.
Mm. Their rise followed the Civil War, and in Meet You in Hell, you say the age of the Founding Fathers was over. The age of the Titans had begun. Would you give us some sense of the scope, the sweep of the shift from one era to the other?
Well, I think prior to the Civil War, the United States was a pretty loose confederation. It was still concept more than a thriving entity. The certainly in the arena of steel, which formed the backbone on which rail and shipping and telegraph and telephone and ultimately the automobile would be formed. The kingpin in world production of steel was Great Britain. Over the course from the end of the Civil War and the sort of coalescing of economic forces in the United States to become a true competitor on the world market, the United States wrested control, economic control of the world economy from Great Britain, who had had it before. And steel was particularly prominent. Obviously, Great Britain was leading the world in steel production. By 1901, the year that Carnegie sold out to J.P. Morgan, Carnegie Steel was making all by itself more steel than the whole of the British Empire combined. And I think that's a metaphor for what was happening in economics and manufacturing, certainly, overall. And it was steel that I think was the base material, the base metal for all of it.
Mm. And it built the city of Pittsburgh.
Well, that's why they call it the Iron City.
Yeah.
It did for years and years.
Yeah. The city...
Not much iron and steel being produced
no.
in Pittsburgh anymore, although there is some. The Braddock, the original Keystone plant, Edgar Thompson in Braddock, still operates, although far differently and in a much reduced state than in Carnegie's day. Mm.
In the late 19th century, how many people were employed in Pittsburgh in the iron and steel industry?
I'm not sure the exact figure in steel, but there were nearly 4,000 people working at Homestead alone in 1892 as the strike neared, and a few less than that at Edgar Thompson. Then, and then of course all the ancillary industries that were connected to steel, including mining and coke and so forth. I'm sure 100,000 people or more depended upon in the Pittsburgh area depended on their livelihoods for steel, on steel for their livelihood.
Yeah. Both men agreed on the necessity of containing the costs of labor. How did they go about that? What was their view?
Well, the cost of labor and everything else, this was one of the business practices that they were of like mind about. They realized that they were in competition with, quite often, fellows who would sort of throw up any bid on a contract in order to get the business when they really didn't have any idea, these competitors, exactly what it was going to cost them to comply. But Carnegie and Frick, in both in their respective businesses before they ever met, were cost control fiends. They wanted to know on a weekly and even daily basis why productivity might not have risen from one shift to the next, or from one day to the next, and certainly from one week to the next. And if there wasn't a reason readily you know, to explain the lack of a raise in productivity, there'd better be an explanation forthcoming. That was the way they looked at it. But they were also very ruthless negotiators when it came to acquiring the raw materials, when it came to negotiating the prices for freight prices to transport the raw materials to the plant and the finished products out. They knew down to the last cent what it was going to cost them to deliver a ton of steel or a certain amount of finished goods to a competitor. And they one of the parts of that equation was the labor that it was going to take to make that ton of steel or those rails or those ship's plates, whatever it might be. And they saw, this was the introduction of the conception of men, you know, of individuals who work for you, into the terminology hands, where they weren't even whole people anymore, but hands involved in the, you know, in the labor equation, or in the equation of production, where labor were just another impersonal part of an equation, of a math problem.
So cogs.
Yeah.
This is the afternoon.
Unfortunately, so although Carnegie would turn around from one day to the next and tout himself as a great friend of labor, he'd quashed a strike in 1884 at the Braddock plant, did lock the men out. He and the plant manager, a man named Jones, troubled by the fact that they were always being countered by the unions when they wanted to decrease wages in the light of falling steel prices around the country. They decided that once and for all they were going to drive this union out. They shuttered the doors in late December of 1884 and let it be known that when the plant reopened, the only man who would be hired would be a non-union man, somebody who would agree to operate as an individual contractor, who would sign not a union contract. There would be no contract signed with the union, but individual workers would come back in. Well, the men held out until about February, but starving and freezing and no money to buy food or coal, they finally capitulated, and each one of them came back in at a wage that had been reduced anywhere from 20 to 33%. And the Amalgamated Iron and Steel Workers Union and the Knights of Labor Union was crushed forevermore at Braddock. Now, of course, it would survive at another installation, but we haven't gotten to that yet.
Yeah. Well, we'll get there. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, writer Les Standiford. His latest book, Meet You in Hell, Andrew Carnegie, Henry Clay Frick, and the Bitter Partnership That Transformed America. We have a listener waiting to talk with us on line one, a caller on a cell phone. Good afternoon.
Yes, I see Mr. Carnegie as a person who, you know, on one hand, he was doing so much for America by his philanthropy, and yet at the same time, like you say, he was doing everything he could to hold down wages and, you know, to split up the union. It just seems like I guess it was cheaper to build libraries than it was to pay his workers what they wanted.
Well, the classic response of the workers about those libraries was, what good does a library do a man who has to work 12 hours a day, 6 days a week? But most of that, and the other thing is, in the wake of that strike, that 1884 strike that I was just talking about, after he'd beaten everybody back to work at a 20 to 33% pay cut, the next day he announced the donation of $50,000 for the building of a library, kind of library and social center, in the town of Braddock as a gift to the men. And he saw, and he wrote about, you know, in his eyes, what a magnificent gesture this was. He saw no contradiction between the fact that he would have these guys back to work at at starvation wages, so long as he would go ahead and build them a library as a kind of consolation prize.
Yeah. Also, though, wasn't his philanthropy kind of, didn't it grow out of his business philosophy in terms of bettering oneself, in terms of his philanthropy was to be matched by the communities that saw the benefits of his largesse?
Well, he had very particular ideas about what he would give money for. One of the reasons why he gave money for the construction of libraries, he didn't give money for books, by the way. He would build the building. And the communities who got the money had to agree to pay for operating costs and upkeep and the stocking of the shelves and so forth. What he built, what he gave, was the money to actually put up the structure, and that was that. One of the reasons why some think that he gave, why he was so fond of that method, he built almost 3,000 libraries around the country and around the world, really. Madagascar, Fiji, Carnegie libraries. One of the reasons why some theorize that he was fond of this mode, he gave very little to universities. He did endow one university, Carnegie University in Pittsburgh, but by and large, he had himself no formal education. A few months of school at a private school, proprietary school in Scotland before he left as a 12-year-old. And then the rest of it he picked up by reading in libraries, lending libraries in Pittsburgh. And he felt, yes, a person could pull himself, anyone could do what he had done, obviously, he believed that, and they could go into a library and read the books that he'd read, and they could become Andrew Carnegie in turn. Hmm. The fact is that most of his philanthropy came after his retirement from business, and thus Frick's charge that finally he realized that he'd become guilt-ridden over how he made that huge fortune, and that was the real reason why he was giving it away, although Frick thought it was a crazy idea. In his defense, Carnegie, you were talking about his own philosophical thoughts in the matter. He had written back in the 1880s, as far back as the 1880s, about the necessity for one who has profited mightily to give back to society in general some of the fruits of that profit. It's just another rejoinder of some of the men who had to work for him. At the time, it was a shame that he didn't give some of that money back in the form of wages to his men while he and they were still alive.
Yeah. Weren't some of his proposed gifts turned down in communities where they saw the money as tainted?
Yeah, for various reasons. Some because once they did the math, there were communities who realized they were not going to be able to afford the upkeep. Mm. Then others who turned it down on philosophical grounds. Detroit, for instance, had turned down a grant based on labor practices. And there were other communities that felt the same way.
Yeah. You grew up in the hills of southeastern Ohio, a son of working-class parents in a mining and manufacturing center. How were these two men, Carnegie and Frick, thought of in the area of Ohio where you grew up?
I think it would depend on which, whose house you went into. When I grew up, and for a large number of working people, Carnegie was seen in heroic terms, certainly in larger-than-life terms, because obviously he allowed a lot of people to make a lot of money that they would not have otherwise earned had there been no Carnegie Steel. He, as I was saying a little while ago, he and Frick were doers and builders, and Carnegie loathed some of his competitors whom he believed to be in the business not of making steel but of printing stock certificates so that they could get rich on the accumulated value of their holdings, much as we saw those sort of Ponzi schemes that has led to a number of people going to jail here recently. Carnegie loathed such people and would justify his own actions in terms of, look, I'm a businessman. I've created a tremendous business. If I am not competitive in my labor practices just as with the buying of raw materials or the negotiating of freight prices, I'll go out of business. And where will we all be at that point? That's what he would have told you. Mm. And Frick would have said, you don't need to explain anything, Andy. Just cash your checks and keep your mouth shut. When I was a kid, there was a, and there still is, a Carnegie Library in Cambridge, Ohio. I think that I was not aware of any of this, and most of the of my aunts and uncles who worked in factories would have told you the same thing. Geez, happy to have the opportunity to be making a decent wage. Mm.
12 hours a day, 6 days a week in the mill at Homestead, and the Homestead Works.
In those days, of course, even 8 hours a day on the assembly line or in a steel plant is pretty tough work.
Yep.
But when you don't have anything to compare it to, or if you're an immigrant just off the boat from Hungary or Czechoslovakia, the fact that you're only getting a dollar or a dollar and a half for those 12 hours a day, when you might have gotten 50 cents for digging ditches someplace, well, maybe that seems pretty good. It's all relative, you know.
Hmm. But in the summer of 1892, the workers at Homestead were not happy.
Well, no. When Carnegie had purchased what he considered and what many considered to be the most efficiently operating steel plant in the world at Homestead, bought it from competitors. Competitors who had, unfortunately, in Carnegie's eyes, and as Frick and Carnegie saw it, signed a contract with the Amalgamated Iron and Steel Workers Union that went with the plant, even if the owners were new. They finally, between the two of them, Carnegie and Frick, though, resolved that when that contract was due to expire in the 1892, there in June of 1892, while they would appear to negotiate in good faith with the union, their intention from the beginning was to see that affairs would reach a stalemate, at which point they would see to the demise of the union at Homestead in much the same way as Carnegie had seen to its demise at Edgar Thompson 8 years before.
Hmm. So things come to a head in July 1892. June and July, but
yeah.
Things explode in July.
Well, what happened was that Frick had convinced Carnegie that the best way to handle this situation was to simply bring in... what Carnegie wanted to do was the same thing that he had done at Edgar Thompson Works in Braddock in 1884. He just wanted to close the plant and essentially starve the men out. Eventually, he said, they'll be hungry enough to come back to work without a union contract. That's fine, said Frick, but meantime, we'd be out of production for as long as it took for them to get hungry enough, and because it's summertime and they can grow their own vegetables and because they don't need fuel so badly, it's going to take a lot longer for them to capitulate. What we need to do is just close the doors and bring in replacement labor, and we'll bring in some Pinkerton detectives to keep order in the meantime. That was the plan. Well, Carnegie finally said, well, Frick, you're my management genius. You've been right in everything so far. If you feel that's what's best to do, I'm with you all the way to the end, not stopping short of a finish fight, he said. I'd seen it written in his crabbed little handwriting, these marching orders for Frick. He said, I'm off to Scotland. Drop me a line when it's all over. And off he went, leaving Frick in charge of the plant and there in late June. Word got around that what Frick likely had in mind, he'd used Pinkertons Pinkertons used in the coal and coke fields of Pennsylvania in strikes involving that industry. So people figured that might be what he had in mind. And on that evening, the fateful evening, when townspeople glanced out on the Monongahela River and saw two barges loaded to the hilt with Pinkerton detectives and all their rifles and ammunition, the alarm went up, and about 2,000 workers and townspeople rushed down to the company docks to try to prevent them, these Pinkertons, from landing. And that's where the terrible trouble began.
Yeah.
There was some shouting and arguing back and forth, and finally the commander of the Pinkertons stepped down the gangplank to confront the leaders of the union, and someone stumbled and fell against someone and stepped on a shovel or a pick handle, which flipped up and hit someone in the face, and a shot rang out on one side, and another shot rang out on the other. People still argue about who shot first. I don't think we'll ever know the answer to that question. But before you knew it, we had a pitched gun battle between 2,000 townspeople on shore and 300 heavily armed Pinkertons on these two barges that lasted through the night and up until about 5 o'clock the next day, at which point about 13 people had been shot dead and hundreds more wounded.
And what happened in the wake of
Well, the Pinkertons
tragedy?
Finally surrendered. They had to walk through this gauntlet of townspeople, and any of them who hadn't been hurt, at least one man was beaten to death by the mob, and most of the others, if they hadn't been injured, ended up with injuries in that sort of secondary conflict. State militia was brought in to 5,000 of them arrived the next day to bring order to Homestead, and the plant went into operation using replacement labor, guarded essentially by the National Guard. And Frick was going to work every day and sending off reassuring messages to Carnegie over in Scotland that all was well, and when the door flew open to his office and he looked up to see a man who'd been in there a couple of days before posing as a labor agent offering scab labor, and this guy, his real name was Alexander Berkman. He reached into his coat pocket, withdrew a pistol, and shot Frick at point-blank range twice in the neck. And when that didn't seem to have killed him, he pulled out a knife and began to stab Frick. Frick gathered himself, overcame Berkman, had him bound up, and the police came to take him away. And they said to Frick, "Well, geez, Mr. Frick, we better get you to the hospital. You're pretty seriously hurt." And Frick's response was, "Well, that can wait. I was negotiating a contract dictating the terms of a contract to a secretary when all this started, and when I'm finished with that, we'll see." So he finishes with the contract. They bring a doctor to the office meantime who says, "Well, couldn't I at least give you some anesthetic while I probe for the bullets?" And Frick said, "No, it might cloud my mind. I said I was trying to get this contract knocked out." So without anesthesia, the surgeon probes into Frick, removes these two slugs at Frick saying, "Oh, yeah, there, I think you're close. Yes, I think you've got it." Out come these two slugs. He's sewed up, and only after he dictates two more letters, one to his mother and then one to his wife, who said there'd been a little trouble at the office, but everything's all well and he'll be home soon, did he allow himself to be taken away. The union president, when he heard about all this, said his pronouncement to the men was, "Well, Berkman may not have killed Frick, but he has certainly killed the union's chances, sure as anything." Because what happened was that sort of swung the tide of public opinion, which had been more or less with the men beforehand, but they'd already been troubled by this violence and the way the Pinkertons were treated in the wake of their surrender. Well, the fact that an anarchist had shown up from New York and tried to assassinate Frick was going beyond the bounds for any fair-minded American to consider. And the implication that the union, even though they had no connection with Berkman, would stoop to such tactics pretty much meant the end of their position there in Pittsburgh. The strike lingered on until November, but it was a moot point from that point on, and finally, the strike settled, union broken. There wasn't unionizing not only in Homestead, at Homestead or in Carnegie Holdings, But that sort of spelled the end for unionizing in steel manufacturing in the United States until well into the Depression, for almost 40 years, into the 1930s.
Well, when Carnegie gets back from Scotland, does he stand by his man, his Patton, his Frick?
Well, he sent some reassuring messages to Frick, telling him not to worry about all this criticism. He did the right thing. But as the world press began to clamor for someone's head in the wake of all these deaths, Carnegie began to circulate rumors to his powerful friends, and particularly those in Europe where the criticism was most heated, that that it was Frick's fault, that he, Carnegie, would never have let things escalate to such a point, and that all along he wanted to have a plant closure he wanted to negotiate with them. And when Frick found out these kinds of rumors, which were absolutely untrue, he went ballistic. Because, after all, he and Carnegie had agreed in no uncertain terms of what was best to do under these circumstances. And that led to, that was the first wedge of acrimony that was driven between the two men, and it led to the ultimate rupture of that once fabled partnership.
Yeah, and Carnegie forces Frick out and then enrages him with his offer.
Where Carnegie wanted to enforce the terms of an ironclad agreement that all the partners had to sign, that if a majority of the partners wanted the single individual out, they could be bought out at what was considered to be par value for the stock at the time. And the trouble with that is that the company had always suppressed the true value of its holdings for reasons of business competition, so that when Carnegie came in to strolled into Frick's office one day, with Frick having no idea what was up, and announced that the partners had held the secret vote, that Frick was out, and that he would be paid $3.5 million for his holdings. Well, that's when Frick went ballistic, because he and Carnegie both knew that the value of that $3.5 million worth of stock was closer to about $15 million. And Frick cried out, "I always knew you were a so-and-so thief," and jumped over his desk and chased Carnegie out of his office. And down the hallway of the Carnegie Steel office, as you can imagine, workers looking up to see the manager chasing the owner down the hallway with his fists raised, and Carnegie ducking into an office and locking the door behind him for safety. That was the last day that the two ever exchanged words directly.
Yeah.
Frick ultimately sued Carnegie and ended up walking away with not 15, but about $31 million. And the only person ever to prevail in a lawsuit or a threatened lawsuit against Carnegie, but profited mightily by it.
Yeah. Which takes us back in a way to I'm thinking now of the messenger who brings the note from Carnegie to Frick in 1919, James Bridge is quite fearful of seeing Mr. Frick, frankly, isn't he?
Well, I wouldn't have wanted to be the person who handed that message to Frick. Bridge had for some time tried to get the two back together, though. He knew them both well, and maybe even in latter years more friendly with Frick than with Carnegie. But I thought it was a shame that these two could not. And he had himself tried to orchestrate a couple of meetings before, which never came to anything.
Yeah. I think if I was James Bridge, I would have had my eye on the door.
He probably did.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you for talking with me this afternoon, and thanks for a good read.
Well, I appreciate it very much. I think it's, we're kind of cynical these days about big business. I thought it was very interesting for me to go back to a time when there was a great sense of possibility, and perhaps we see the seeds of what led to this more cynical attitude about big business. At one time, though, these guys were doing grand and amazing things, and that was a big part of the appeal of it for me.
Mm. Les Standiford has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of Meet You in Hell, Andrew Carnegie, Henry Clay Frick, and the Bitter Partnership That Transformed America. The book is published by Crown. It's 9 minutes before 2 o'clock. settlement prices should be in. From the Chicago Board of Trade, here's Todd Gleason.
You bet they're in on this Friday afternoon, Celeste, and the futures finish the day like this. In the corn pit, futures are up anywhere between 2 and 7 cents. The nearby contract, September futures, trading in a fairly fast trade today. The best gains there up 7 1/4. December futures up 6 1/4. The beans were mixed for the day, unchanged, down 1, up 1. We'll go through all those numbers momentarily. In the wheat pit, futures were higher as well, following the corn pit. Futures in the September contract at 349.5 high, low at 342.5. Settlement price there at 348.5. They were up 4 for the day, by the way. Just as a reminder, the July contracts expired yesterday at noon, so they are officially off the board. And the Septembers are all the lead contracts in the wheat and the corn, and August in the beans. December futures now in the wheat pit, 362.75, the high, the low at 356.5. Settlement price there, $3.62 1/4, up 2 3/4. March contract at 376, high, low at 369. Settled at 375 1/4. They were up 4.5. And the May futures at 379, high, low at 378. Settlement price at 379, narrow trade, up 4 cents for the day in the May contract. In July of next year, 378, the high, the low at 372. Settlement price for next year's wheat pit, 377 3/4. July contract, up 2 3/4. From the corn pit, now September futures up 7 1/4 today, 258.5 the high, low at 250.5. Settlement price at 257 3/4. Once again, 7 1/4 higher. December contract up 6 1/4, 269 the high, the low at 260.5. And a settlement price there at $2.68. They were up 6 1/4 for the day. The March contract up 4 3/4, 272.5 in the corn pit for the high, the low at 265.5. And a settlement at 272, up near the very top of that range, up 4 3/4 for the day. May contract, 273 3 1/4 high, low at 266, settlement price at 272.5, and they were up 2.5 for the day. And the July contract for next year in the corn pit, 275 the high, the low at 267, settlement price at 274 3/4, they were up 2 3/4. September futures, 265 the high, the low at 262, settlement price at 264 1/2. Up 2 3/4. September oats, 182 3/4 the high, the low at 179. Settled $1.82.5. They were up 4 in December futures, 185 the high, the low at 182.5. Settled at 184 3/4, up 3 for the day. August futures in the bean pit, $7.30 the high, the low at 719. Settlement price at 721. They were up 1. September futures, 733 the high, the low at $7.22.5 a bushel, and the settlement at 724.5, up 2 1/4 for the September soybeans. November futures now, $7.41 the high, the low at 729, settled closer to that low, 731.5. They were up 0.5 for the day. The January contract unchanged, 731.5 the settlement price, the high at 42.5, the low at 31, even for the January 2006 contract in the bean pit. March futures, $7.33 the high, the low at 722. Settled 722.5. They were down 2.5 cents. In the May contract in the beans, 715 the high, the low at 706. Settlement price 707. They were off 0.5 for the day. Bean meal August contract now, 228.5 the high, rather 228.50, which is 0.5, but we'll put it at 50 for the day. 224.30 the low, and a settlement price of $226.70. They were up $3.40 for the day. September futures, 228.70 the high, the low at 224.70. And a settlement price at $226.50. They were up $2.80. August bean oil, $25.85 high, low at $25.41. Settled at $25.48. They were down 2. And the September, $25.90 the high, the low at $25.50. Settlement price there at $25.62. And they were off 3 cents for the day. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
And the contracts that we follow, everything down today. August feeder cattle, the high today, 106.30, the low 105.40, the settlement 106.15, that down 197.5. September 105 even, the high 104.15, the low 104.70, the settlement, that down 245. October feeder cattle 104.10, the high 102.95, the low, the settlement 103.57.5, that down 220. August live cattle 78.80, the high 78.05, the low, the settlement 78.52.5, finishing down 42.5 cents. October live cattle 81.65, the high 80.80, the low, the settlement 81.20, that down 85. July lean hogs, 68.77 and a half the high, 68.50 the low, 68.67 and a half the settlement. That finished up 15. August, 66.65 the high, 64.85 the low, 65.75 the final price, down 30. October, 58.85 the high, 57 even the low, 57.57 and a half the settlement, that down 135. December lean hogs, 55.90 the high, the low 54.50, the settlement 54.95, that down 75. July pork bellies, 64.40 the high, the low today 63.20, the settlement 63.20, that down the limit, down $2. The Dow is up 13 points at 10,642. The Nasdaq 6 higher at 21.59. The S&P 500 up 2 at 12.28.
The Carle Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carle Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Jenny Feldman from Cross Village, Michigan writes, Dear Dr. Science, why do some of the ice cubes pop right out while other ones stick to the side of the tray? Mom said you would know.
Making generalizations about ice cubes is just as insulting to the ice cube and reflects just as poorly on your level of enlightenment as making generalizations about different races or cultures. An old ice cube adage goes, 16 cubes in a tray, 16 different rhomboids. Another goes, no angle is really 90 degrees, especially when you deal with water. No one ever said ice cubes were poetic, but they do have a tolerance for diversity that you apparently lack. Maybe if you could see things from an ice cube's angle, it'd help you escape from the narrow prison of your own mind. Find a walk-in freezer and spend a few minutes with the door shut, imagining life in an indented blue plastic tray.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI. For more information about Dr. Science, go to drscience.com.
2 decades ago, Alec Jeffries had no intention of making history.
The last thing on my mind was identification and forensics and paternity cases and all the rest of it.
But his accidental invention of the DNA fingerprint has had profound effects. A conversation with the man who made DNA forensic testing possible today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 WILL Urbana.
It's 1 minute before 2 o'clock, 83 degrees in Urbana. This is WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. I'm Celeste.